In this weekend's episode, three interviews from this past week's Washington Journal. First, two top magazine executives discuss campaign 2024 and the political fallout from this week's debt limit drama on Capitol Hill. Rich Lowry, editor-in-chief of the National Review, and Katrina Vandenhoevel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine. Then a conversation with Philip Wallach, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, on his book, Why Congress.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
We begin with Rich Lowry, editor-in-chief of National Review.
What lessons should Republicans take from the debt ceiling fight of 2023?
Well, the most important move for Republicans was getting that initial vote to pass a measure out of the House, which some people were skeptical McCarthy would be able to do. He managed to do, and that really wrong-footed the White House from that point on. The White House really thought they wouldn't be able to do something like that, and they could just jam a clean debt ceiling down their throats. That didn't happen. You got a deal that is unsatisfactory in many ways, but Republicans got something out of Biden when Biden was determined not to give them anything. Some spending restraint, or all sorts of gimmicks that are going to be involved there, some policy reforms, marginal increase in work requirements on food stamps, some permitting reforms, some incentives that to get Congress to actually do its job in the future and pass appropriations bills rather than some enormous unread omnibus bill at the end of the year. So all that's good, but is this does this solve our fiscal problems or put us on a different trajectory fiscally? No. So Chip Roy and the gang are right about that.
Is Speaker McCarthy's speakership safer from internal challenge today than it was a week ago before this deal was announced?
Well, this seemed the main obstacle to him, right? He would have to go to Democrats to pass it, which he did, and there'd be a revolt based on that. There's not going to be a revolt based on that. But for the right part of the caucus, this is a strike against him, and it makes it more likely, they might try to get him, take him down next time around. But so far, McCarthy has performed amazingly well as Speaker. Given those all the votes and the drama it took him to get there, he seemed like he'd be incredibly weak. Instead, he's been incredibly deft. And to this point, he's the beginning of wisdom as a congressional leader is keeping your caucus together. This has been the secret to Mitch McConnell's success over the years. And McCarthy so far has been able to do that. Now, the fallout from this will be a major challenge in that respect going forward. But he's, I think, performed better than reasonably could have been expected at the beginning of the year.
The main thing Democrats and President Biden got out of this is that the debt ceiling has been suspended until after the next presidential election, until January of 2025. Should Republicans have fought harder to have this debate again during the 2024 election, leading up to the election?
Yeah, I'm not so sure, just because given the way these things bounce, you can end up being blamed when you think it's the other guy's going to be blamed for a showdown or a stalemate. So it is a risk to both sides. Some of my colleagues are very exercised about the fact there's not a dollar amount on the extension. Instead, it's this suspension. But apparently that's something Republicans wanted because they don't technically they haven't voted to extend the debt limit to any given number. I'm not sure how much that matters one way or the other. But if you're the White House, your position that you weren't going to negotiate, weren't going to go clean debt ceiling, what was blown up, weeks ago, and I think inevitably was going to be unsustainable. So if that's your standard, you've suffered a bad defeat. If your standard is you get through this, push it past the election, there's no economic turbulence, and you haven't given up much, But by that metric, it's a success for the White House, too.
National Review is nationalreview.com. Rich Lowry is the editor there. You've been speaking of the 2024 election, writing a lot about the 2024 election. Real Clear Politics, their average of polls, have the latest numbers at Donald Trump at some 53% in the Republican primary, Ron DeSantis at 22%, everybody else in the low single digits. Do you think those numbers provide an accurate picture of the state of the Republican primary right now?
Yeah. You want to be Donald Trump. You know, you want to be the guy who's above 50%. And the key inflection point here, there's been a lot of criticism of DeSantis maybe should have announced earlier or been more aggressive pushing back against Trump earlier. The key inflection point in the first 6 months of this year was the Bragg indictment, which DeSantis had no control over, that everyone who knew anything about Republican politics or had any common sense knew would help Trump. And sure enough, that Trump would occasionally pop above 50% in some polls prior to the indictment. But after the indictment, he was on a different trajectory, was routinely above 50%. There have been some polls where he's been above 60% nationally. And DeSantis didn't lose a huge amount, but lost some. You know, they're clearly just trading voters back and forth to the extent there is volatility in the national numbers. But, you know, it's Iowa. The early states make a huge difference. The DeSantis people are very confident about Iowa. They're obviously going to focus a lot on Iowa. So if you're DeSantis people, you'd want to see the national numbers tighten up some. But the main thing is, are you competitive in Iowa and can you potentially win Iowa? And I think the answer to both of those things is yes.
A column you recently wrote for Politico, the anti-Trump strategy that might actually work. Ron DeSantis, the first Republican since 2016, who's really playing to win. What do you mean?
Well, we've heard criticisms of Donald Trump, quite fierce criticisms of Donald Trump from Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and other Republicans who were likely to retire or lose primaries. This is the first time we've heard full frontal criticisms of Donald Trump by someone who intends to have a future in Republican politics, actually intends to define Republican politics. So the DeSantis criticism of Trump, it's been in some respects carefully crafted, which I think is important. You know, he's not attacking him on character. He's not attacking him on January 6th or any of that. But he is pushing back forcefully, counterpunching on issues where DeSantis is to Trump's right, which is very important because he needs to pry some very conservative voters away from Trump and making the broader case that Trump can't win and that Trump can't govern. And for those reasons, he's a poor choice. And he has showed, and his operation have showed no fear whatsoever of Trump. And I think that's important because we didn't know that was necessarily going to be true before he got in.
Let me just give viewers an example of some of what you referred to in that column. This is from last week. Ron DeSantis, after his announcement, went on Ben Shapiro's show. This is about a minute of that interview.
By moving left. So this is a different guy than 2015, 2016. He attacked me for opposing an amnesty bill in the Congress. He did support this amnesty, this good Latou. 2 million illegal aliens he wanted to amnesty. I opposed it because that's what America First principles dictate, that you're opposed to amnesty. He also attacked me for voting against an omnibus spending bill that was bloated, full of pork, and that racked up huge amount of debt for this country. Yes, I voted against the omnibus. He signed every omnibus that was put on his desk. And so I think it's odd that he's doubling down on those positions, because those were instances in which his actions did not match his campaign rhetoric. And I also think just the difference between 2015 and 16 and now is I, as chief executive of Florida, and he as chief executive of the United States, we both faced COVID-19 and we both responded in the way we did. He responded by elevating Anthony Fauci and really turning the reins over to Dr. Fauci, and I think to terrible consequences for the United States. I was the leader in this country in fighting back against Fauci.
Rich Lowry, on that interview, those statements from Ron DeSantis.
Yeah, so as we see, he wants to get to Trump's right to the extent he can. People tend to forget in 2016, Trump's strength, you can look at Republican voters in three buckets: self-identified very conservative voters, self-identified somewhat conservative voters, and then you have a pretty slender slice of moderates. Trump's strength in 16 was the somewhat conservatives. You know, the very conservatives were with Ted Cruz. And then over time, it kind of switched. And Trump is now strongest with very conservatives. DeSantis is stronger with somewhat conservatives. So he needs to win those very conservative voters. He needs to make a case to them. These are folks who are very conservative, as they call themselves, but identify with Trump. You know, they voted for Trump twice. They like him. They hate his critics. They feel very defensive of him. They like what he did as president. So you're not going to win them over by saying Trump's a terrible person and is unfit for service. You potentially could win them over by saying, you know what, Trump, he did a lot of good stuff, but he's changed. You know, he's not the same. And he didn't do a lot of these things he promised. And I'm a better bet to get it done. So that's the case he's making. Am I sure it's going to work? No. You know, if you're betting on this race, you're betting on Donald Trump, no doubt. But I think there's no question, on the other hand, that DeSantis is in the game.
And one of Donald Trump's strategies, responses, has been that Ron DeSantis has changed, pointing out that Ron DeSantis used to praise Donald Trump quite a bit, to the point where the Trump campaign released a video on the former president's Truth Social account highlighting the times that Ron DeSantis praised Donald Trump. Here's a minute of that video.
Donald Trump has done a better job of appointing judges, both on the Supreme Court and the courts of appeal, than any Republican president in modern times. Than any Republican president in modern times.
Donald Trump wrote The Art of the Deal. He knows how to negotiate. He's a master negotiator. Trump instinctively is tough on China. The strong horse is who they respect. The president's a strong horse. And Donald Trump's credit, nobody else was really willing to talk about that until he came on the scene. And he's leading with purpose and with conviction.
And President Trump has followed through on that.
Donald Trump's gotten a heck of a lot done. Donald Trump's gotten a heck of a lot done.
I think President Trump kept his word.
Other presidents have promised it, and they reneged on their promise. He kept his promise.
But he said, we are going to deal with this one way or another. Just think of how big a mess this president inherited from Barack Obama. Yes, North Korea, Iran, ISIS caliphate, China on the move, Russia on the move, Syria in disarray. He inherited all of that. We've made a remarkable turnaround, and I think he deserves credit.
Rich Lowry, does Ron DeSantis have to walk back each one of those remarks?
I think we've heard from him a little bit on this. He said in an interview the other day he didn't want to criticize Donald Trump when Trump was president and getting criticized from the left all the time. Of course, Trump is still getting criticized from the left all the time. I think that the DeSantis explanation there can just be simply, there are a lot of things I liked about Donald Trump, a lot of things I thought he did that were good, but there are also things he failed on. And I didn't want to emphasize those when he was president and make it even harder for him to try to do his job. But this is, I think, a pretty good hit for Trump. I think also trying to portray DeSantis as a tool of the establishment makes sense for Trump, and kind of minimizing his accomplishments in Florida, saying, look, the state was already on a good trajectory and, you know, it's 80 degrees and sunny, as Trump has said at times. All that makes sense. But the thing is, Trump, he's such a fierce fighter. He uses any tool at hand that he's attacked DeSantis in ways that make no sense and open him up to a counter volleys. One, all the stuff with the name, making fun of the name, I don't think that any of that works or helps Trump. And two, you know, attacking him on his COVID response and saying, oh, Cuomo is better than DeSantis. Also, Cuomo is a major villain for Republicans and enables DeSantis, as we heard in that clip with Ben Shapiro, to say, you know, look, he Trump was wrong on this stuff. He went along with Fauci. He went along with lockdowns much too long. So I think a more focused approach would work for Trump, but what's worked for him in the past is just attacking on all fronts as hard as he can until he finds something that works.
That was National Review Editor-in-Chief Rich Lowry.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Next, a view from the other side of the political spectrum. Katrina Vandenhoevel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, Congress has now passed this debt ceiling compromise. Was it a good compromise from your perspective?
John, good morning. It could have been worse. It could have been worse. Got 2 years to 2025. I think that progressives, Democrats should work to avoid another scenario where Republicans are keeping hostage the American people. The savage cuts that were first on the table, savage cuts to really mostly women and disproportionately African-American women are still there, but are fewer. But, you know, there's a kind of philosophical, not to get too big a word going, about this fight. There's in the media, much of the media kind of talks about the extreme right, the extreme left. The extreme left wants to make sure this is a healthy country, that you have tax cheaters held accountable, that we don't give to a Defense Department that is the largest by 10 times of any other in the world. But I think, you know, it gets characterized as false moral equivalency. I do think the Progressive Caucus stood strong. There were people there who voted no, Ro Khanna being one, and explained why. But I hope this country won't be held hostage again to this process. It's a lot of spectacle. At the end of the day, it's not clear how it rebuilds a healthier country.
We're set to hear from President Biden tonight, 7 p.m. Eastern, and viewers can watch it here live on C-SPAN, also on C-SPAN.org. What do you want to hear from President Biden tonight?
I want to hear, it's a cliche, but that the fight goes on, that this is a, you know, a kind of session in a longer fight to take on the forces of money, the forces of corruption, and to talk about how politics, which, John, I could hear your callers, there's a sense of politics as being a crass, craven, you know, highly transactional game. Well, it's transactional, but it should also be transformational. I've always believed that politics at its best improves the conditions of people's lives, especially those lives which need, a lifeline that government has in the past provided. It could be a boost. It could be bigger than that. But I hope Biden speaks about a country that is still in great need. I know he'll probably reference maybe Ukraine. I'm not a pacifist by any measure, but I do believe that we do better by getting our own house in order before we go out into the world, which doesn't mean we don't work with others to bring peace. But I do hope there's some reference to working with others and trying to build a world that is not riven with military engagement. I would recommend to your listeners, it's the 60th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's American University speech at American University, where he spoke about the importance of peace, of ending war, as a way of reconciling differences.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, our guest, the editorial director and publisher at The Nation magazine, one of the nation's oldest progressive magazines. What does it mean to be a progressive in the year 2023?
It's a very good question, John. You know, liberal has been a term. The Nation at its best, The Nation magazine, maybe The Nation is at its best when it's a forum for debate between liberals, progressives, the left, conservatives with a conscience. Most of all, The Nation is independent. And I think, you know, on some issues, John, we have not sided with a liberal progressive community. I mean, the majority of that community in 2003 sided with the decision to go to war under George W. Bush in Iraq. I do think progressive means fairness, means a level playing field, means getting money, big corporate money out of politics. I was struck watching Howard Dean. I don't know if your listeners, viewers remember Governor Howard Dean. He was, an unusual player. And then he ran for DNC, Democratic National Committee chair. But, you know, he spoke about the coming election, John, and what he really fixed on was the party of money. The party of money is really the party that will decide to some extent which candidate, we're talking Republican here, will move forward effectively. And I think that, you know, is a dangerous measure and a corruption of a society. I do think Bernie Sanders changed our valence in our politics in important ways. And one way, though it's hard for others to do, I mean, remember he was, what was it? I can't even remember now, but it was like $20, you know, give me $20. But he had a number that was affordable and that showed that ordinary people could participate in our political process. The money gains, the money on many sides has just assumed too important, too dominant a meaning in our politics.
Is Joe Biden a progressive for those on the left that have concerns about that this bill was too harsh for things like new work requirements, concerned about deals made, whether it was infrastructure or the CHIPS Act? Should Joe Biden be worried about the progressives as he runs in 2024?
So Joe Biden is perhaps the most pro-labor president we've had in decades, perhaps since Roosevelt. He has filled the agencies which allow a level playing field for labor. He's filled them with very good people. He has spoken about an industrial policy for this country, which means rebuilding many elements of this country. He's also a liberal. I think, you know, he's doing a job that is as good probably as you can do at this point right now with the configuration of forces, the constellation of forces in Washington. However, it would be important, and I don't see it happening, to have, as we saw in 2016 and 2020, a populist force inside the party running against Biden, because it would push him to take positions he might otherwise say he doesn't have to touch. And I think that's a measure where he will get more of a free ride. The nation, where we sit, we're looking very closely at House races, Senate races, key states. We are not at the moment making a case for a candidate to run against Biden. So that's, you know, I think he's certainly seen the problems with our trade policy in a way that President Obama, certainly President Clinton, did not. And I think that is a measure of reality, because trade has played into, you know, Trump won in 2016 to some measure because there was a feeling the establishment in this country had forgotten workers who had been shafted by deals like NAFTA, other trade deals. So there is a reorientation of the Democratic Party in that arena, the economic arena. And I think that's important.
That was Katrina Vandenhoevel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. like the Gray Strandom Wing Chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Finally, Philip Wallach, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, discusses his book, Why Congress.
The title doesn't pose it as a question. It's more of a statement of what we're trying to achieve with the book.
The book is an apology for Congress of sorts. It's really, Congress is at the center of our constitutional system, and this book is a brief for why we need to value it as such, why it's the only place where we can bring together the diverse elements from across American society, mix them up, and get them to accommodate each other. If we try to run everything through the executive branch and make everything depend on presidential elections, that's just too much weight on one person's shoulders. We end up with big sort of simmering anger. And we really need to rely more on Congress to deal with our nation's biggest problems. That said, I know there's a lot of skepticism about Congress as an institution these days. This book tries to address that head on and say, why have the current problems in Congress grown up the way they have? Where did they come from over the past sort of half century of evolution of the institution?
Oh, well, let's start there then. What is, as far as key problems that may be seen as far as how Congress works, what would those be?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that pops to everyone's mind first is just the overwhelming bitterness of the partisanship on Capitol Hill today. And I think that comes from some sources outside of the Congress, but it's also just become part of the culture of the place itself. So part of this book is a plea for legislators to direct their energies towards solving the problems that face the American people rather than just trying to worry about the next election and framing their opponents in the worst possible light. Now, closely along with that problem is leadership dominance, is one of the major themes of the book, is that right now we're in an era when the leaders in both chambers, you know, the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader, are just incredibly powerful in determining what is on the agenda in each of their chambers. They haven't always been such absolute gatekeepers. There's sort of been more decentralized power at different times in Congress's past. And so part of the point of the book is to tell members, you don't have to arrange things this way. It's up to you to decide the organization of Congress, and you can make things more decentralized, more open to sort of factional interplay rather than just sort of getting the two parties in their trenches.
You write in the book, this Congress as it currently structured tends to reduce the nation's complexity into two polarized warring camps. Party leaders who view politics as zero-sum struggle for control arrange the legislative agenda according suppressing free-flowing and provisional coalition building that would force factions to see each other as potential collaborators and allies. Instead, leaders marshal the interests of their, quote, team to gain every advantage possible in the service of tactical victories today and electoral victories tomorrow. Can you elaborate from that?
Yeah. So, you know, we don't have to agree on everything to agree on something. But it sometimes seems like the message coming from the leaders on Capitol Hills is we agree on enough with our own team that we always have to stick together with our team and we always have to keep the other side away. I think there's active counsel from the leadership in both chambers, don't do bipartisan deals. That complicates our message at the next election. We want to look at those swing districts, and we want to say why it's so bad to have the other party control those swing districts. We don't want to give the members from those districts some legislative wins. And so they're really prioritizing winning the next election over dealing with the country's problems now. And they're sincere in believing that really is the best course for the future of the country. There really is a lot of mutual suspicion amongst the two parties today and a sense that somehow everything hinges on the next election. But it seems like every election gives us that sense. And we have to zoom out a little and realize, you know, it's not always the end of the world. We sometimes just need to be able to see the commonalities and see the problems that we can put our heads together and find solutions on, even when we aren't going to agree on everything.
You talked about that decentralized way of Congress. What does that look like in a day-to-day world with Congress?
Sure. So if we think back to Congress of a couple generations ago, you know, one of the most famous figures was Speaker Sam Rayburn. His name is on one of our House office buildings today. And he's remembered as sort of a towering figure. But his model of the speakership was completely different from, say, Nancy Pelosi's. He was sort of the broker in a very complicated coalition, right? The Democratic Party back then contained Southern arch-conservatives and Northern urban liberals. It was a stranger coalition, sort of more historically contingent in many ways. But his mastery of Washington was managing to get all those people to come to the table and deal with each other, sort of directing traffic in that complicated coalition. He was never somebody who said, it's going to be my way or the highway. That just wasn't how Washington worked back then. And so you had a model where committee chairmen were really sort of the most important power centers back then. There was a sacrosanct seniority principle that meant that they were going to keep their chairmanships no matter what, as long as, you know, and they weren't in any danger of being thrown out of their seats in sort of more the single party, the solid South. So that was a very different model that led to different dynamics, sort of forced all these different factions to work with each other, you know, and Republicans were sort of a permanent minority party within that regime, but figured out how to pick their spots and advance their causes within it. So that's just a different model. I think some people think that as long as the two parties are so closely matched as they've been in recent years, that they're going to continue to sort of focus on butting heads with each other. But I think there's a lot of frustration on Capitol Hill from our lawmakers who feel like their jobs have been reduced to just sort of pulling the lever the way their leaders tell them to, and they don't even feel like they're getting a constructive chance to work on legislation that's going to have a chance of consideration. So I think there's a chance to reorganize things because of that frustration.
That was Philip Wallach of AEI on his book, Why Congress. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website at cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television. Live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.